The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm Angela Kelly Robeck, host of the Empowered Principal Podcast, a part of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back. Steve here. And today I'm talking with Doreen Gary Nelson, and we are talking about her awesome book, Cultivating Curiosity, Teaching and Learning Reimagined. What an inspiring book. Lots to learn. Thanks for listening. And by the way, it would be so awesome if you talked to your friends, your colleagues, your family members and said, hey, have you listened to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 lately? Huh? Well, you should. And show them how to get there and share your favorite episode and make them a listener. How about it, huh? That would be so awesome. Thanks for doing that. Thanks for being a listener and enjoy the show. The intro and outro were created and performed by Brian K. Buffington. You can find more about Brian at briankbuffington.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for his newsletter. Thanks, Brian. Cool, huh?
It's the Education Podcast, your favorite show, with lots of groovy guests and they share what they know. So crank it up to 10 and let your neighbors know that here's another show with Dr. Steve Mileto. Teaching, learning, leading, K-12. Teaching, learning, leading, K-12. Teaching, learning, leading, K-12. With Dr. Steve Mileto.
Doreen Gary Nelson is Professor Emeriti of California State Polytechnic University, Pomona, School of Education and Integrative Studies. Adjunct professor in the Cal Poly College of Environmental Design, was professor at Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California from 2002 to present, and in 2019 was named founding director of the Design-Based Learning Project by the UCLA School of Education and Information Studies Center X. An award-winning 50-year veteran educator and published author in the field of education, Nelson began developing her design-based learning methodology, formerly called City Building Education, in the late 1960s to ignite creativity, promote high-level transfer of learning, and foster cross-curricular critical thinking skills among K-12 students using the spatial domain. She was named one of the 30 top American innovators in education by the New York Times in 1991 and is the recipient of both the American Institute of Architecture's prestigious lifetime honorary membership, the highest honor for a non-architect, and the California State University's statewide 2006 Wang Award for Excellence in Education. Today we'll be focused on her book, Cultivating Curiosity, Teaching and Learning Reimagined. Doreen, thanks for joining me today and say hi to everyone.
Hi, everyone, and Stephen, so happy to be with you.
Doreen, let's start by talking a little about you, and it's great having you here, and I've read your book, and it's awesome, and I really, and by the way, it's made out of some really cool paper. It's like, it's got, I've been showing it to all kinds of people. They're like, this is neat. So, let's start by talking a little about you. In your bio, I read that in 2019, you were named founding director of the Design-Based Learning Project by the UCLA School of Education and Information Studies, Center X. Could you tell us what this is?
Center X is one of the most prestigious teacher training institutions in the United States. And to be invited there is a great honor for me. To be part of it. There's now an endowed position, an endowed directorship in my name at UCLA Center X. They do teacher training. Center X does teacher training in math, in science, in social and emotional training, the whole ball of wax. They have probably 20-30 different offerings, and we are the only one of all their offerings that is not a subject matter. We're a methodology, which is different, and now are working with the subject matter directors to weave the methodology as a way to deliver their subject matter. Subject matter is really important, but as you know, how you deliver it is even more important.
Very much so, yes. So, Doreen, what we're going to do is let's start taking a look at your book. It's called Cultivating Curiosity, Teaching and Learning Reimagined. And could you kind of tell us a little bit about why you wrote it?
I'd been teaching and working for a long time, developing my methodology. I started back in the 60s, and I've been started out when I had to beg teachers to think the way I was trying to think. And I wrote this book, I guess, for myself as a young teacher. When I started writing, I had such a hard time. I'm not an easy writer. Some people are. I had to, you know, pump myself up to think about who is this book for. And I had to think about myself as a young teacher. But I also, at Cal Poly Pomona, for 25 years, I was able to have a master's degree program in my methodology at the university. And during those 25 years, I met and trained a lot of K-12 teachers and in the methodology. And there was one teacher in particular that I stood out as I was writing the book because she represented many teachers. She was a high school English teacher. She had just started teaching, and after 1 year, she hated it. And she was about to drop out because that's what's going on right now, Steve. I mean, a lot of teachers are having exactly Stephanie's problem, which is it's just too darn hard. And I imagined her because she came into to study with me, and she's still teaching. I think she just became a principal of a school, an assistant principal. And it's to imagine her as a young teacher and imagine myself as a young teacher and to write a book to encourage young teachers is what John Dewey did for me. It's what someone named Herb Cole, did you ever know him? He was a wonderful educator who wrote a book called 36 Children, which was all about his experience in teaching.
Gotcha.
And those books for me were so inspirational as a young teacher. And I wanted to impart some of my joy of teaching and learning and the intellectual part of our profession, because there is a serious intellectual part. And that's what I like so much about you, Steve. That you are really interested in that intellectual underpinnings of why the hell you're a teacher in the first place, or why you're an administrator in the first place. You know, what are you doing this job? And I wrote this book to try to inspire teachers, administrators, anybody who wants to read it. My next book I'll write for parents because I think, you know, you know that if you start a movement of thinking and you're on the cusp of something that's new that you're presenting to the world, it can go away very fast. So the fact that I was able to sustain this work for me today is a miracle. I'm very grateful to all of these teachers and these school districts who have embraced the work, because we're in one school district in California, San Gabriel Unified School District, where the design-based learning, my methodology, is written into their mission statement. Nice. which is wonderful, and all the teachers in that district have training in this methodology. That would be my hope. It's not that everyone is going to do it exactly my way, and it's not. I hope to God that doesn't happen. I want the creativity of teachers. I think teachers are undermined. They're not given the applause and the stage for. They're not allowed to think for themselves. Everything's too prescribed. They go from one training to another. The school districts jerk them around. They run around from one training to another. And having a methodology allows them, I call those polka dot trainings, because it's hard to put them all together. You know, one week you're doing social and emotional learning, and the next week you're doing math, or what, depending on what grade level you're in. And I work with K-12 teachers, and it's always subject matter versus the delivery system. If you have a methodology that feels comfortable to you, you can deliver anything through it. And now John Dewey had done that for our American education system. In the late 1800s, he had provided the United States with an educational philosophy and a methodology that allowed our country to thrive. That included thinking about the child, the curriculum, the society, the relationship between the curriculum and the society. And he was my hero, because he really presented something that lasted for so many years, and it did. His work almost 100 years, John Dewey's methodology permeated our country and helped us thrive, because it had a lot of focus on democratic thinking. In 1957, when Sputnik went up, we threw John Dewey out the window, and we began just focusing on subject matter, subject matter, subject matter. And we know where we are right now. We've got kids that are committing suicide. We've got teachers that want to commit suicide. We have teachers that don't want to be in the profession. It's a mess. I don't claim to be the know-it-all that's going to fix it all, but for God's sakes, we've got to remember that teachers matter. They go into this profession. It's a hell of a hard job, and they should be given some wiggle room about how to deliver stuff. They should not have to have the kids read page 7 and answer the questions on page 8. We all know that doesn't work.
Oh, you're so right. The one of the big problems and complaints that have chased a lot of teachers away is being responsible for like solving poverty, being responsible for solving, you know, all the academic turmoil that some of these families have gone through, and so those unrealistic expectations have kind of driven off a lot of them, which is amazing.
The main job of a teacher is to ignite and cultivate curiosity so that kids want to learn, they know why they're learning, they're excited about coming to this place called school. It's not a chore, that they can interact with their peers, that they can find commonalities of things that they like to do together and reasons for being together besides, you know, trashing each other on social media. A school really has to dominate the scene that is really horrific right now, and we have to re-engage. You know, kids are always saying, why do I have to learn this, teacher? Why do I have to learn this? Well, my methodology was conceived, and I talk about that in the first chapter of the book, it was conceived to really try to answer that question. I was working with kids in my first class in Venice, California, and it was a very mixed bag in the 60s. It was the late 60s, and we had, you know, a lot going on politically in our country. And we were somewhat in a similar position. The kids weren't interested in coming to school. They weren't interested in learning. The teachers were complaining about this, that, and the other. And I had done a lot of research for my master's degree in transfer of learning, because that's kind of my big research area. It turns out that if you can learn something someplace that is general and that sticks to you, you can reuse it a million times in a million different ways. And the way I conceived of getting it to stick to the kids was to have them design their own original things. And I did it by having them build a little city in their classroom, a city of the future. And that's prevailed in my methodology because it's turned out that everybody knows something about the city or thinks they do. And there are misconceptions and there are things we've all said, oh God, why don't they do this in the city? Or why don't we have a this? And you give that power to the student and they just bloom because they're invited to come in and think about their future, to design what it's going to be when I grow up. And I had a kid in one of the early classes that said, we built a city in my classroom. We all had parts of the city and we all had to make it all work together. It was so hard. We had a government and it was so hard and we worked together and it was so hard. I'm not sure I want to grow up, the kid said. It's too hard. Grown-ups have a hard job. But that's a wonderful, for me, that's our job, is to show kids a window on their future, to give them a preparation. That's what education is. It's preparation for the future. That's what John Dewey thought it was. That's what I think it is. And I'm sure it's what you think it is, too. And it's what parents want for their kids. Parents just sometimes don't know what the future is or how to get there. And they went to school where everybody sat in straight rows and they read page, you know, 7 and answered the questions on page 8 and they figured that was good enough for them. So why, you know, let's do it for my kid. But it's our job as educators to help parents see that there's more to it, that we can, the parents that we have waiting lists of parents, coming into our program in Walnut Valley Unified School District, there's a wing. They built a design-based learning wing of the middle school just for this methodology because the waiting list was so long. There were 150 parents on a waiting list for the school, so they had to just, you know, they finally built a building for us. That's the kind of thing that is slow to grow. It doesn't happen every day. I can only tell you 2 or 3 of those stories, but we need more of that. And your podcast and getting this information out to people is very, very important. In my book, I tried to, as much as I could, to tell stories about these teachers that I've worked with through the years and to elevate the role of the teacher to something other than just, a textbook.
It's so powerful what, if allowed to be able to do what they do best, working with kids, it just can be such a thrill to work and to have something to do and helping a kid figure out what that pathway is going to be. And, you know, one of the things that, and just as a note, in your book, you have these great examples of all different levels, and you have some great color pictures, which I thought that was cool, too. You got color pictures in there. And so you get to see the detail of what they're working on and things like that, which I loved. And if we could for a minute, let's kind of shift into the book. And in chapter 1 of your book, Cultivating Curiosity, Teaching and Learning Reimagined, chapter 1 is titled Shaping the Methodology. And you begin to explain the development of the Doreen Nelson method of design-based learning with its 6.5 steps of backwards thinking. One of the titles here is not arts and crafts, which I love, by the way. And you note this wasn't an arts and crafts project; it was the design-based learning backwards thinking process. So, could you explain what design-based learning backwards thinking is?
Yes, I will. First of all, thank you for reading the book so carefully and your thoughtful comments. The methodology, which I call backwards thinking, really originates from something all of us know. Haven't we all tried to talk a kid into doing something? haven't many of us had an experience of trying to feed a baby. You're trying to feed a baby or your kid, and instead of saying, you know, eat this and you're good, stand there, you say, here comes the airplane, right? That's backwards thinking. You do it. You trick them. You do something that's not expected that grabs the learner. And my methodology, the 6.5 step thing, is interesting for me because I never wanted to make this thing a rigid thing, rigid 6.5 step thing. The teachers I worked with over the years said, "Doreen, you've got to do this." In fact, that 6.5 step chart was designed by a middle school teacher, not by me. But it does give you the idea that you start with, what do I want to teach? You know, what do I want to teach? What's the overarching big idea of what I want to teach? What am I thinking of that I need to teach? And then how do I go about coming to a presentation of that? And one tool that I borrowed from the design professions, which is extremely useful and it works for teachers in all subject matters, is called I call it a criteria list. When a client goes to a designer and says, "I'm going, you know, I'd like to hire you to design my whatever it is," there, whether it's written or spoken, the client usually comes with what I don't want. I don't want, you know, white windows, or I don't want whatever it is I don't want. And there's usually a list, you know, I don't want small rooms, I don't want whatever the client is telling. But then there's this other list, which is, what do I need? What do I really need? You may not want small rooms, but you may need 5 bedrooms, and the lot may be too small. So if there's always this back and forth between the don't wants, what don't I want, and what do I really need, and there's that trade-off, that negotiation with self between what I can handle. In the 6.5 step process, the don't wants is a place where the learner can err. If they're building a city, all the things I don't want in a city. If they're building a biome, all the things I don't want in this ecological environment. If they're building if they're making a business, all the things I don't want to have happen. But then on the other side of the bed, on the other side of the coin, there's this list of what you need, and that comes from the curriculum. Because if you're building a city, you may want, and you're a math teacher, you're going to put in scale. If you're a science teacher, you might put in a lot of stuff about ecological things and things that you need to have the self-sustaining city. These would come from the teacher's own curriculum. So when people say to me, "Do I really need to build a city?" and you read that in my book, the answer, of course, is yes, because you, as the teacher, tailor this city to your curriculum, and you do it using the criteria list. Armed with that list, normally, in design professions, you would start designing you'd go to the library and start to do some research on these topics, so that if you were a science teacher, you would go and find out all about the ecological constraints of building and so on and so forth. But I start backwards because I'm doing the dirty trick. So the dirty trick is, and it's not so dirty, it engages the students, it gets them right away into themselves and into self-expression, which is what this whole thing is about. If you can express yourself by designing what you think before you have to go to the library, you know a lot of things, perhaps. Maybe you don't know a lot of things, but at least get them out on the table and get them, you know, presented to the other people in the room, to your peers, and start talking about it. And it grabs every learner. We've had autistic. I had a teacher in my master's program who dealt with autistic kids, and even those kids were really enchanted by the idea of building this thing. So teachers, some administrators have been, you know, the ones that walk backwards. The teachers used in the early days when I started, the teachers used to have to pretend they weren't doing it when the administrators came on board. You know that story. You're smiling. The whole idea of backwards thinking, when you have a methodology, it doesn't matter if you build the city over and over again. You build it in kindergarten, you can build it in high school. The high school chemistry teacher is doing it to study the periodic table and find out what the elements are. The kindergarten teacher is doing it to have the kids, you know, find out what are the jobs in the city. There's a different entry point, no matter who you are.
That's so awesome. I love it. And, you know, and I appreciate you explaining this, because obviously this is, you know, the big focus of the book anyway. And, you know, so good stuff. I mean, what I want to do is let's take a look at another chapter for a minute. In the beginning of chapter 2, you state, "What I had to figure out first, however, was key. How to teach students to access the higher level thinking associated with creative and critical thinking so that they would achieve non-specific transfer of learning. I have two questions here. And the first one is," and I really have three. So I crammed two together and a third one by itself. "But can you explain what the higher level thinking associated with creative and critical thinking is and looks like? And why is it
remember,
important?"
I think we all remember Benjamin Bloom and Bloom's taxonomy. Bloom, yes. Benjamin Bloom was at the University of Chicago. I had the great pleasure to meet him for 1 hour in my lifetime. And he, when I met him, I was very young at the time, and I asked him a question that was very cheeky. I said, why did you develop the taxonomy? And he said, "Because educators are at low level thinking. They're doing repetition and they need to be doing high level thinking. And I wanted to," and he used the word, "embarrass them into paying attention to these higher level thinking skills." These higher level thinking skills are the more open-ended skills. They're the more thought-provoking skills. They're the skills that may, when you think, when you have higher level thinking skills, you wonder about things. You want to know about things. You wonder how this is something over here is like something over there, which is transfer of learning. And I got interested in it because these higher level thinking skills, if you teach to higher level thinking, you are really in the realm of transfer of learning, because you can't say, "How do I compare what I design to what, say, a great Michelangelo designed, you know, or Picasso drew? How does mine compare to that?" The minute you ask yourself a question like that, you are thinking about everything that Michelangelo might have done and all of Picasso's decisions in his lifetime. So that's why I turned Bloom's taxonomy, which goes from low level to high level, I turned it around, and I started with the high level thinking, which is design. Design is the highest, design and creative thinking are the highest level. And I thought to myself, as this young teacher in the 60s, if it's so darn important, let's start with it and let's not wait to get there. Because if you start with the low-level thinking, you get bogged down and you sometimes never get to the high-level thinking that you mean to get to. So let's use the high-level thinking as the entry point, turn it around, and then reach back into the lower-level areas of finding information to support the high level thinking. And building the city, actually, it's only one way that I know. I'm sure there might be 100 other ways, but it's what I've devoted my life to, is being able to talk about this high level thinking so that information can be used and reused. Transfer of learning as a topic, it was very interesting to me When I was doing my research on the 60s, there was very little information on it. They talked about two kinds of transfer of learning, low-level transfer. You could drive a car, you could drive a truck, you could, you know, this that simple kind of transfer. But then there was this other thing that was described as high-level transfer, where you could do something in one area and then use it in another. You could learn how to brush your teeth and then you could learn how to polish your car. That there would be elements of things that you learned that were transferable, not to the same task. And I think that's the most important part of teaching and learning. And when I read Jerome Bruner's book, and I fortunately, Jerry Bruner wrote the introduction to my book, as you saw the that little piece that he wrote in the front, and that was just before he died at age 100. Wow. He became a friend and he became a mentor to me, and he really bothered me as a young teacher, and I told him that's why we became friends. I said, in your book, The Process of Education, you talked about this kind of thinking as being the most important thing, but you said it was too hard, and I was mad at you. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to show him. And it's true that if you have to really focus on what you want to do with it. You have to be deliberate if you want high level transfer of learning. You have to ask I did a research project with Apple Computer for a number of years, where we were working in the schools as a researcher, and we found that if you want transfer of learning, you have to ask for it. You can't, and then the way you ask for it really matters. Like most of us usually say, "Look, you're writing a poem about." Da da da. Tell how it's like the moon, or tell how it's like a glass of water. That's not asking for it. That's telling it. We found out that if you want transfer of learning, you have to say to the learner, "How is this like that? How is this like that? How is what you did over here like that?" You have to get inside the learner's brain, and that's pretty simple to do. It takes the teacher a little bit of time to learn that, because we're so used to, as teachers, saying, "Look, this is just like that." But we found out that if you say "this is just like that," the teacher's doing the learning, not the kid. Gotcha. So if we say, "How is this like that?" we're opening the door for the learner.
Very cool. Yeah, they would. I would think that they come to the. They help develop their own ideas about what it is that they're doing.
And they have to. You're right. And they have to understand that information is not disposable. It can be used over and over. And when they see that, they get very excited. And we have just amazing testimonials and test scores. Stephen, you would be very happy to know that we've collected so much data. We wouldn't be here if we didn't have the research data at our fingertips. Their test scores, the kids do better on the standard tests. Their speaking skills are better. Their collaboration is better. The teachers have fewer discipline problems in the classroom. Collaboration takes place naturally. They're not antagonistic. They become a family. They become a community. They're building the city. They have to build it, and they become the mayor, and they become parts of it. And even during COVID, which was, I never expected this, and I wrote about it in the book, the teachers began experimenting with what do you do with those breakout rooms? Because when students went into the breakout rooms, they turned off their screen. The teacher didn't know what the heck was going on in the room. And it was a very unhappy situation. the design-based learning teachers had a mayor and they had city council districts. When they went into breakout rooms, they weren't just going into breakout rooms. They were going into the city council district meeting to decide what kind of energy they wanted for their city of the future. They were coming, they were making a decision for themselves in their own creative thinking, and they didn't turn off the cameras. And they wanted to report back to the whole city. And they had, when they had a town meeting, they brought everything they did in their breakout rooms back to the town meeting. So I am now in sort of semi in love with Zoom and the breakout rooms. If it has to happen, there is something to say for it. I never thought I'd live to hear myself say that, but here you do.
That's and it's you're so right. I mean, there's so many places. And considering I started with Skype a long time ago, and then changed it because there are people who recommended some of these other items and pizza. All right, these other items and stuff, and they and it's just interesting how I got to talk because I got all this stuff going through my head. One of the things that I wanted to mention to you was that what was so cool was seeing those pictures of what the kids were building in the classrooms when you talked about the cities, and then your descriptions of the different ways that they handled it, and I just thought that. It was just neat. I'm glad you shared that because it's one thing to read a description of it, but it's another to see how different it looked, when it, in the results of what, whatever that group did, whatever that, whoever that group was working, whatever age they were.
And you can imagine for a young learner of any age, if they design, say, an energy system for their city, and then they present it to the whole group, and they get criticized for it, they're not going to fall apart because they're going to defend them, you know, why they did it. And then the teacher becomes the guide. Well, let's do some more research and find out more about this kind of energy. I was with this one little kid who was telling me about, he was a fourth grader. He was telling me about geothermal energy. And I'm thinking, oh, what just happened here? The teacher, he had designed this kind of energy that looked like geothermal energy, but he didn't have the word for it. And the teacher was able to guide him to the textbook to look at it. And then he proudly said, I want geothermal energy for my city.
Excellent. So,
It's that kind of thing, Stephen, that keeps me going, and it probably keeps you going too.
Oh, most definitely. I mean,
if you can connect, my methodology is based on connecting how you do it, the physicality of learning, building things, making things, to the intellectual part in an interdisciplinary way, and. My methodology is a structure for delivering any subject, any content, from English to chemistry to anything you need to do. And it has succeeded for a lot of teachers, and I hope we will have more.
I'm sure you will. It's awesome. One of the things I want to going in a little bit more specific. I mean, and you talked a little bit about some of this earlier, but I'll kind of go back to it. In the beginning of chapter two, you state, what I had to figure out first, however, was key, how to teach students to access the higher level thinking associated with creative and critical thinking so they would achieve non-specific transfer of learning. And so this is where, you know, I wanted to make sure that I brought us back to this because, we talked about, can you explain what the higher level of thinking is? And we did that. Well, can you also explain what the non-specific transfer of learning is?
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As I mentioned earlier, there's specific transfer of learning, which is if you can drive a car, you can drive a truck. Non-specific transfer of learning is the kind of learning that generalizes. It's where you can think about where you're taught to think about how, let me see if I can give you an example. We were doing a research project in music at the Open School. And the students were looking at sounds and how to organize sound to make, instead of just making songs, they were looking at how you look at sound to organize a piece. And they were looking at all the elements of music, how you can make sound, you can make the rhythm faster, you can make it slower, you can make it higher, you can make it lower, you can do more of the same thing if or you can just da, 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 da. We were teaching them all the, I was working with a composer. And the transfer of learning that took place was when the kids realized that they wanted a sound to be bigger. And instead of us telling them, oh, you can make it bigger because you can make more of it, or you can make it, how else can you make it bigger? And we were sitting in a room where there were Venetian blinds on the window, and the composer and I were just knocked out when the kids jumped up. They had, one of the kids had like the sound of pages in a book going, he liked that sound. He wanted that kind of sound in his piece of music. And how we're talking about how you make it bigger, and five kids who had all been the book and all had wanted them to be bigger got up and went over to the Venetian blinds and played the Venetian blinds louder, because if you run your finger up the Venetian blinds, it's much louder than it is in the book. That's high-level transfer of learning. We didn't tell them to do that. They figured that out, because they high-level transfer of learning is when the learner figures out that what they want to do, and B, where they can find the answer to it.
Oh, most definitely. It makes perfect sense. It makes a lot of sense. And
there are other examples, I think, maybe better examples in my book. My brain is a little fried, but I think that if you think of high level transfer of learning, it's really the stuff that allows you to use it and reuse it and reuse it. For example, you do these podcasts, and you have a standard kind of procedure that you want to talk to your people about, but you don't want to use that same procedure all the time, because it would be boring for you, and it would be boring for them, and besides, it wouldn't meet the needs of the person you were talking to. So your high level thinking is, how do I take what I have and make it be different, and how do I make, that's high level thinking, right?
Gotcha. Yes, definitely. That's cool, because it's you have to think what questions do you have about how it's going to best serve or address the what's going on or work within the environment which you've created or something like this. And I like that.
But even so, you need the outline, because you need, when in order to get high level transfer of learning, you have to have something that holds you down that you can go to. And the city for me works like your outline. The city is there, and then you can go into these higher areas. You can think about energy. If that's the subject matter you want to talk about, it's almost like energy would be your guest that week. And then you're building the city would be like your outline, and then your next week you would maybe talk about movement, ways to move around the city, how you would get around in the city. Yeah, then the next week you might talk about shelter, about how do people want to live? What kind of shelters do they want to live in? What do they want their life to be? Another week you might talk about how people, what they do for recreation and physical health. So, but you still have the outline. You still have this thing called the city, which is like just like your outline for the program. And then the higher level thinking happens when you take all these different points of view on a single idea.
I like that. I like that. It's very good. And one of the things that I want to make sure that we talk about is that when we got into this, you know, we started by talking about design-based learning programs, and then that there is yours, the Doreen Nelson method of design-based learning. What makes yours different?
I'm so glad you asked. Well, there's also project-based learning, which gets thrown into the mix here. And I'm always asked, you know, because project-based learning right now is a very big topic, and I don't want to poo-poo any of these because they're all great. There's the difference in my methodology. You start with creative thinking. You are not replicating things. You're not making a bridge. You're not making a house. And you may have noticed in reading my book that I talk a lot about what you call things when you ask students to be original really matters. If you ask them to design a house, you know what you're going to get. If you ask them to design a shelter, you'll get something different. And I'm interested, and my work has been predicated on opening that door, opening the vocabulary. My methodology is different from other design-based learning programs in that way. It's also different. I studied because of my connection to the American Institute of Architecture, which they've been very supportive of my work and have believed in me more than the educators when I first started. And in fact, at Cal Poly Pomona, I was brought there by the School of Environmental Studies, not by the School of Education. I was there for 8 years before the School of Education said, oh,
wow.
Maybe she should be here, you know. So the designers have really embraced my work big time. But there is another difference. Is there's something called the design process. And in the design process, which is, I think it's a 7-step process that is taught in design schools, you state the design problem, but you do research before you build. So I've just twisted things around. I didn't do it knowingly. I had done that before I read about the design process. So
nice.
It was an instinctive thing for me. And I think that for me, that's the main difference of turning it around so that you're not starting with the research. Because even when I first taught at Cal Poly in the School of Environmental Design, I noticed things that really bothered me. Students were asked to replicate, you know, can you design a mask that looks like a Frank Lloyd Wright building? Well, how about having them design a mask that looks like them? And then we'll worry about Frank Lloyd Wright. We can do that nice high-level thinking of comparing your mask to Frank Lloyd Wright's buildings, you know. So that was the impetus of my work.
I like that. That's awesome. So cool. You know, one of the things that I want to make sure that we mention, because we already talked about him. I brought, you know, you talked about him. I brought up the fact that you have these pictures and you have these color pictures that show you what's going on and what you're talking about, which is excellent. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, was there a lot of thought that went into putting all these examples in there? Because you made sure that, I mean, you have it from different levels. You have it from different, it's not like you went to like one high school and you did this one day. It's lots of different kids and different levels, and they're all working on stuff. And I was just wondering, you know, where that idea came from to include this much, you know, to include that, especially to make the pictures color. I think that's it makes it so easy.
First of all, it took me 10 years to write this book.
Gotcha.
That didn't mean I was writing it every day, not at all. But, you know, I was thinking about it. And I did most of my writing in about 2 years. But I was so, and I still am, I'm so amazed by the talent of teachers and their enthusiasm for this methodology and how they come to life. These teachers I'm working with in San Gabriel, where the whole San Gabriel Unified School District, where the whole district is using the methodology. If I were to take you to the classroom, you'd want to take pictures of it and put them, plaster them all over the world. These kids come up to you, walk into the classroom, and a little second grade kid comes up and says, "Hi, I'm the mayor. Can I take you over here and show you my city?"
Nice.
And all the kid starts talking. Then you go to a high school class, and the kid comes, a bunch of high school kids come up to you and say, "Hey, you want to come over here? We've been building this city. It's really cool. You know, you want to see what we're doing and why we're doing it. We learned all this stuff about the periodic table." You want to show the pictures of those cities because they don't look alike, and so. And their interdisciplinary learning is not the same in each setting.
That's so awesome. I found myself going back to the pictures as I read more and going back to the pictures because it kind of gave you a feel for what you're talking about, what's going on, the teachers are doing with the kids and all that. And I thought it was nice because there's a lot to look at. It's not like you just put one picture in. Like a lot of books, they put like one picture in and that's supposed to hold you over for the rest of the length of it. And I like the fact that you included all those.
It's not a how-to book, but a lot of very smart teachers that I've met can take it and do a lot with it. I'm working right now on writing a series of guidebooks to be companions to this, to help teachers how to do a starter city, how you start out with it. So those will be forthcoming.
Nice. Very nice. Yeah. You know, one of the things that in section two of Cultivating Curiosity, it's titled "Goodbye to Formulaic Teaching." Could you explain what the reader will take away from this section?
I hope they will take away what I wanted. Actually, I wanted that to be the first part of the book because I care very deeply about teachers. And that section is about teachers who have gone away from formulaic teaching. And it's a whole chapter of their voyage, of things that they've done that have made them get in trouble with an administrator, made them not get in trouble with an administrator. And I wanted to show the bravery and the courage that many, many teachers have because they believe so passionately in the students they're teaching. I think that we have a profession, Steve, that's made up of human beings. You don't go into teaching if you don't really... It doesn't mean you love children, but there's something about it, whether it's you love imparting information. That was the impetus for me. I wasn't a lover overall of kids. I love the idea that as an adult, I could take information that I know and give it to others. And that chapter is really about, it's an honoring of those teachers who have done this and some of their... there's one story that I tell about a teacher that I overheard while I was in the bathroom, and I think it's a funny story, where I'm locked up in a stall, and she's at this training, and she's out, you know, washing her hands, and she's talking about how she hates these kinds of trainings, and I thought, oh boy, I'm not leaving the stall.
Very nice.
I knew which one she was, and she hated it because they teach you things and then you can never use them. And she was on a soapbox, you know, going on and on and on. She became the main person in the training, and she loved the work, and she went on and became a trainer in her community. I think that whole section of the book is my love letter to teachers to say, you know, go for it. Do your stuff because you matter.
That's excellent. And just a note, what's funny is, you know, as we're getting closer to the end, you know, I started finding some chapters that were really, really cool. And they're just short little reminders of what's going on. But I thought they just really grabbed your attention. And one of them was It Takes Courage, which is chapter 10. And I really like this. It's just a little short episode. It's titled It Takes Courage. Share a little about the point of including this. I mean, why did you mention?
I remember it.
That's all right.
Let's see. It's about, Emily. That's a very telling story. Here is this middle school English and history teacher who's having the kids eat out of her hand. She's in our master's program. And the darn administrators from the school district go in and visit her classroom and tell her that her classroom's too messy and the kids weren't learning anything. And, you know, and she came to class in the master's program in tears, and she said, I don't know what to do. And I didn't know what to do. And I said, well, you just won't be able to be. This master's program, by the way, I was very lucky. I got the approval of the Academic Senate to have a master's degree program based on what teachers do in their classroom. They wrote about what they did in their classroom, not what they found out at the library.
Very nice.
And I said, you'll just have to go to the library, Emily, in this case, because they won't let you do the stuff. And she started weeping, and she said, no, I'm not. I can't. My kids love it. I love it. So I said, well, I'll come and talk to them. So I make an appointment. We go and talk to the administrators, and they didn't even know what they were seeing. They hadn't done their homework. They hadn't done their research. They thought she was teaching history when she was teaching language arts. They didn't even know which class of hers they were visiting. And then they told her to stop. Well, because I was the big deal professor from the university coming in, they let her go on with it. But she moved very quickly. She just decided, the hell with this school district. And she went to another school district. And when the superintendent for the other district called me to get a reference from her, I said, look, Emily is a thoroughbred. and she's got to be given the room to run around and to do what she needs to do. She's Very not nice. The ordinary front of the mill teacher. She has the courage to really do what she believes in. And if you want that kind of teaching in your school district, hire Emily, which he did.
Excellent. One of the things that you talk about in this book is something that I think is so cool, because you mentioned it once before about the possibility of tricking someone. And just a note, I skipped over a chapter because I had at some point started cutting back on what I was talking about. But the chapter I skipped over, I got to mention this too, because you talk about chapter 11 is all about when the administration gets it, which I thought that was awesome. And being a former administrator, I thought that was a pretty powerful chapter. So,
well, some of the teachers don't get the administrative support. And if they do, an administrator can do a lot. And you know that. I mean, you were awarded a great honor as an administrator. So I wish you'd been my principal at school, because obviously you had the ability to give the teachers their own voice. And that's a very big talent. Most administrators want the teachers to have their voice. There was one administrator in Pasadena Unified School District, and her design-based learning classrooms, they were wonderful. The kids were engaged. And she called me into a meeting. She said, do they have to build a city? It's so messy. And I thought, you got to be kidding, lady. You know, like, they're getting good test scores. Leave me alone.
What more do you want? Right. That's awesome.
That is the importance, Stephen, of having an administrator who believes really in the kids and believes that the teachers can get someone and takes the time to find out what a methodology is and isn't shoving subject matter down everybody's throat. You can't get social and emotional stuff happening in a classroom if you're shoving subject matter down everybody's throat. It ain't going to happen. It doesn't happen.
That's awesome. Awesome reminder. I like that. And just as a note, I don't understand why some administrators can, having been one, you know, some of the things that people block and stand in the way of make no sense because of what we're about. And, you know, we're about trying to help kids. To me, I've always said this, we're about trying to help kids achieve their dreams. And it requires to understand the kids. It requires to know how they think and breathe and what they focus on. And it requires so much stuff. And to have an administrator then take time to interfere with the teacher connecting with the kids and helping them build their dreams and all that sort of stuff is hard to understand. I don't.
And then, Stephen, if you really ask yourself, what is the job of the school? The job of the school is to prepare human beings to live in society.
Right.
And our society right now is undergoing terrible stress with what's information, what's misinformation, what's real, what isn't. The political part of it, when in my methodology where the kids are building a city and running a city, they're seeing what's real and for that at their grade level, they're seeing what's real and what isn't. And the political aspect of it is as important in my mind, it's hand in hand with the social aspect, because you know well as an administrator, you want those kids to come back and say, I voted. And I knew how to do it.
Yes.
We had a situation early on, and it just happened again recently, where we got a call early on from the middle school asking us what we were doing with these kids, because they had become all the leaders. They had become all the leaders in the middle school. They were on the council, student council. And were we teaching these kids strong arm techniques? So they were bribing other kids. And
nice.
We were knocked out by that. And this happens over and over again. That's what we want. That's what you're doing as an administrator. That's what you care most about. We're serving society.
Gotcha. Gotcha. It's just pretty wild when you read your words, you know, and you think about it though, just think about the things that stop things from happening. And a lot of times it makes no sense why that power stopped whatever was going on. So, but good stuff. One of the things that I wanted to make sure that I brought out is I was going to Chapter 12, and I took a little detour by Chapter 11 there about administrators getting it. But Chapter 12 is also one of my favorites, and it's called Try a Little Trickery. It works. What were you wanting the reader to get when she finished this chapter?
Well, that's that backwards stuff where you come in, you know, you come in the back door, and you don't, the kid doesn't exactly, the learner doesn't know. You don't start out with, we're going to learn about the periodic table. You start out with, we're going to build a city, and then we're going to learn about what elements it's made out of.
Nice.
So, I mean, that's the trickery aspect of it. Yeah, there's a wonderful story in here of a third grade teacher who had... They gave her the worst class. The administrator figured, well, if you want to do the design-based learning methodology, we'll show you. We'll give you the worst kids.
Jeez.
And she had them eating out of her hand. No, because they were building and they had power. Being the mayor of the city gives them some power in the classroom. And then if the teachers use that as a parallel transfer of learning exercise, where they say, well, you're mayor of the city, you can be president of the class. So if you're the commissioner of utilities in the city, you can take care of the sink in the classroom, you know,
nice.
And the lights. in the classroom. So I talk about that in section three, that parallel and transfer possibility. But if the minute that happens, where the kids have dual roles, that there's something in the city and there's something big in the classroom, it's it changes. One of the teachers I really want to tell a story about is this man named Miguel Fernandez, because he used the city also for this trickery thing. And he started out by having them build a starter city, and the kids all wanted a lot of animals, wild animals, you know, zebras and all the stuff they'd read about. So they made a city in their own community, and they put a river there, and they put all the animals on the other, on one side of the river, and all the people living on the other side of the river. And he, this teacher, was so theatrical in his ways, in his trickery, and he had a piece of land on their property, so he would build some stuff too. A second grade teacher, and he would come in and say, "Oh my God, a bird, a mean bird from where the animals were living, flew over and ate my dog." Nice. And they were up in arms. So then they figured out something to put around, you know, some and they enclosed their animals in something. Then he had a situation where he wanted to teach about immigration, and he had. I got a message from somebody who wants to come and live in your city. This is a new person that wants to move into your city. And he was thinking about, you know, immigration, right? A new person wants to live in your city. Where should that person live? And they all said, he should live with you. Yeah, they didn't want that person to live with them. You know, who's going to take it? And then he let that go, and then he told them, "Oh, it turned out that that person has magic powers," and nice. They all wanted that person.
Right, nice, very nice.
So there, and that's not part of my methodology, Stephen. That's the creativity of a classroom teacher.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, it's, you know, it's a big deal to unleash that creativity, and you know, unfortunately, there are those who would prefer that all the ducks line up and be in one row. And yeah, it's not really teaching. Teaching is messy, and it's all the ducks not in a row. They're going there and there and there and there, you know.
Nice way to say that. And I'm sure you were a messy leader.
Thanks. I appreciate it. I was. It's like, you know, you have to watch out for stuff like that. You know, you just have to, I guess the best way of what I'm thinking about is like, I used to tell my team that, you know, we have teachers in the building that are pretty much, you know, they're special children, and I'm talking about the adults. and I said, and you know which ones I'm talking about. And we named them just in case to make sure. But I said, they're terrible at doing paperwork, but don't you get all over them over their paperwork, figure out how to help them do their paperwork, because they're brilliant with the kids. Okay. And those aren't a dime a dozen. Those are the ones that you want to relish, you want to develop, you want to help them accomplish what they need to accomplish. And you know, in those days, I mean, there's a lot of paperwork that an individual teacher was required to submit and make sure it was turned in on time. And some of them were the worst ones ever. You're going, okay, it's 9:15. We're supposed to have this report so that we can take care of attendance, and we don't have it from, let's guess, it's usually the same four teachers, you know. It's like,
But I like what you did so much, because the other teachers really trash those teachers.
Yes.
They make life very hard. I was one of those teachers. You were probably one of them too.
Yes,
and we get bad press from the rest of the teachers because they, you know, they think that we should be like them, and we're not. And actually, they want to be like us.
I think you're right.
So I'm hoping that my methodology will unleash their inner self in some way.
Oh, I think it will. I think it will. I think that's so cool. You got me thinking about all kinds of stuff there. That's neat stuff. Doreen, we're coming up on closing, and before we do that, can you let everyone know where they could connect or learn more about your book and such?
First of all, the book is available on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble at both places. And there's a website at Center X. It's long. It's centerx.gseis.ucla.edu/design-based learning. It goes on and on. Or you can just designbasedlearning.org is a simple one.
Gotcha.
And it'll take you, I think it's linked to the UCLA. We have a not-for-profit corporation that has its own outreach as well as Center X, but we're linked together.
Very cool.
You can find more information about opportunities for K through 12 teacher trainings, and you can sign up for our newsletter, which will let you know what's going on. Some of these stories. Dave, the high school chemistry teacher, wrote an article about his classroom. It just got published in the Hechinger Report, which is a big deal, and he's so excited, and all the teachers are really excited, and your high school chemistry teachers would love to read Dave's report, and that'll be on our website soon. It just got published last week. I guess that's it, no? But the other question I'd like to ask you is, in your capacity, I hope that we could talk about some ways that we could connect some of the districts that you work with and bring this to some of your people. We go all over the world. We have programs in Japan. We had a program in Israel. The Chinese just bought 6,000 copies of the book. We'd love to come to Georgia.
That'd be awesome. Love to have you here. It's sharing it. Cause that's what, once we produce this, then I'll be sharing it. And I've already shared you're getting people to take a look at your book and everything. And I think that's a big part of it.
If anybody's interested, we could do online trainings. We could do in-person trainings. We're mobile. We have a cadre of trainers, and
awesome.
We're available to do whatever we can to get the word out. We want kids to be happy and well-adjusted and stop this nonsense that's going on in our education system.
Oh, so much so, and so powerful, and it'd be nice to be able to bring that to an end. And I will continue to share, and I will make sure that people listen to it and see what we can do about getting some of your trainers here, because that would be cool.
I hope you'll stay in touch with me, Steve. I so admire you.
And well, thank you. We can figure
out a way to work together. I'd love that.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Well, thank you, Doreen. It's been a pleasure meeting you, and I love your work and all this stuff. And so that'd be cool. We'll stay in touch. So, if I could, before we close, I got two last questions I'd love to ask you. And one of them, they don't have anything to do with your book or the research or what you do. The first one goes like this: how do you keep going when so much is going on that you may want to quit?
How do you do it?
It's what I did was, it's funny is I originally put that question in there because I was running into so many teachers who were just frazzled because they got so much, and I had it, and they'd ask you, how do you do it? How do you figure out how to do something? And to me, what works for me is I have to take the big picture and I have to narrow it down to one step at a time. And I have to do that. And I have to stop looking at everything I got to do. And I just look at how can I chunk it up and handle those chunks one step at a time. And that's what I do.
I have a sign on my computer that says, keep the main thing, the main thing.
Nice.
And that's very hard to do.
Oh, yes.
Because you get pulled off to the side. And I can give you lots of examples. I mean, you get angry at at somebody who didn't do something the way you wanted it to be done, and you spend all your energy on that instead of thinking about what's the main thing here. What is the main thing is the work. How can we get this somebody to do the main work? And if we can't, how do we get rid of this somebody so we find somebody to do the main work? The main thing is the main thing, and let's not start to, I have to really keep that at the forefront of my thinking, because you, and as an administrator, you know, you get pulled in so many ways, the union, the parents, the, you know, everybody. And in our work at UCLA, there's just a lot of politics. I thought Cal Poly was rough. UCLA is no different. And I think those politics make me angry. Because they impede progress. It's almost as if they're roadblocks for our future. And I have to force myself to forget the roadblocks and to keep going. And what keeps me going is the stories the teachers tell. And when I'm with the teachers, I come to life and I think, oh yeah, that's why I'm here.
Gotcha. That's awesome. That's awesome. I love it. Last question goes like this, Doreen. Do you have a teacher in your past who made a difference in your life? If so, who was it, and what would you say if given the chance to say thank you?
A geography teacher at UCLA really piqued my interest. I was a geography major. I was a music major, but then I was a geography minor. And geography, really good geography professors aren't teaching you to locate the mountains and the valleys and all that stuff. They're teaching you the relationship between the physical terrain and culture, and how the physicality of the actual physical locations change the values and the beliefs of human beings that live in certain places, and that the rituals get developed very often as a result of location. And he gave us a final exam problem that we had to write to. We had to write about Thanksgiving in 100 years in the future. And I think, thinking back on Dr. Spencer, I would say to him, you drove me crazy. I spent hours and hours in the library reading all about the whole history of Thanksgiving. I learned more about Thanksgiving than I ever cared to learn about.
Excellent.
And what, in the end, you gave me the privilege of inventing, and that's backwards. He gave me the privilege of inventing what my idea would be of Thanksgiving, instead of telling me to go and write about Thanksgiving and how Thanksgiving relates to the landform. He didn't do that. He asked me to put it in the future, like I do with the cities of the future. You put it in the future, and then, oh my God, you have to think about the past. You have to think about the present. So thank you, Dr. Spencer.
That is excellent. I love it. Thank you for sharing. And Doreen, thank you so much for talking with me today. Your book, Cultivating Curiosity, Teaching and Learning Reimagined, is amazing. It's not about arts and crafts, and it definitely takes courage, but what an amazing focus that those that learn from you will have. All educators should read Cultivating Curiosity, especially administrators. It has been great learning from you, and I wish you all the best in what you do.
You too, Steve.
Hey, you have been listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast to help you help kids achieve their dreams. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a member of the podcast network based in Canada called Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Hey, thanks for listening. It would be awesome if you visited my website at stephenmileto.com and connected with me, left a review, and listened to more episodes. And by the way, you could also share it with your friends, with your family, and your colleagues. Thanks so much. You're awesome.